We've been going through the Sermon on the Mount. We've been going straight through the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount, I'm convinced, has some of the most not only challenging, but at the same time confusing parts of the teaching of Jesus that often, I think, is open to and subject to a lot of misunderstanding. And so we're going to try to understand what Jesus is saying. We don't want to stop at understanding it. We also want to live it out. And sometimes it's hard to understand it, but it's always hard to live it out. And that's what we really want to strive towards and focus on here. So we are in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, verse 38 through 42. It's printed there in your bulletin. If you didn't grab one on your seat, there should be one nearby somewhere that you could grab. Matthew 5, 38 through 42. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who begs from you, and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you. So we've been going straight through the Sermon on the Mount, bit by bit here. And the main message on the Sermon on the Mount, as I've said at times in the past, the main way to boil it down, to summarize it, is this: be different. That if you're a follower of Jesus, it means that it will change and transform your life. And if your life hasn't been changed, at least in some degree, and probably in a lot of degrees, if your life hasn't been changed by an encounter with Jesus or by a profession of believing in Jesus, then it may be that you haven't really truly embraced the message of Jesus, because the message of Jesus is life-changing, radically life-changing, such that it makes your life to be radically different than what we see around us. If I heard someone put it in a similar way to this, but if I came in here and claimed to you all that I had just jumped into a pool with all my clothes on, why would you not believe me if I looked just like I look right now? Because I'm dry. That's exactly right. There is absolutely no evidence that I just jumped into a pool with all my clothes on, because you can't see that my clothes aren't wet, my hair's not wet, my hair's not messed up. And so if you claim to be a follower of Jesus, yet it has made no difference, there's no evidence of that in your life, then it may be because you haven't really started to follow Jesus. And so we've been talking about in the Sermon on the Mount as we've gone through that salvation from Jesus is an utterly free gift. Back to the beginning, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of God. You can only receive God's kingdom, receive his salvation, receive Jesus, God's love and favor into your life if you realize you don't deserve it and you could never earn it. But once that does come into your life, then it starts to change you. Then it starts to change the way you live, such that the way you live doesn't earn God's love, but the way you live is a reflection of God's love having come into your life, having started to change your heart. And so that's what we've been looking at. And now we're coming to what I think, I probably say this every week, now we're at what I think is one of the most challenging parts of the Sermon on the Mount. I think I said that every week because I spent the week thinking about it, thinking about what it means, and every week I have a new feeling that this is now the most challenging part of the Sermon on the Mount, but, you know, so take it for what it's worth. We're coming to a very challenging part of the Sermon on the Mount. One of the things that, let me tell a quick story, and then we'll jump right into it. One of the things that is adorable, one of the many things that is adorable about my one-year-old daughter is that she loves to share. She loves to share, but only theoretically. When she has something that she likes, she will wave it at you and smile and wave it around until you take it. And then once you grab it and take it, in that moment, she realizes, wait, maybe I don't love to share as much as I thought I did. Because in that moment, she realizes the true cost of sharing, that she is now missing out on the thing that she once had. And she realizes that she only liked to share theoretically before she experienced the cost of sharing. And then once she shares, she realizes it's not really what she wanted. And when we think about this topic that Jesus is dealing with, I think we can think about it similarly in that most of us don't want to think of ourselves as vengeful people. Most of us want to think of ourselves as peaceful people, as generous people, as giving people, as humble people. But in that moment, when we've been wronged and we realize the cost of what it means to be wronged and to have wrong come at you and to absorb wrong, in that moment, we realize we only didn't want to be vengeful people theoretically. Because in that moment of experiencing the wrong is when we realize how hard it is to endure wrong, how hard it is to receive wrong, the great cost that comes with being wronged. And all of a sudden, things are different. And vengeance no longer seems like something we would never want to, we would always want to avoid, but now it seems like the thing that's the right thing to pursue. And so it's really a human, universal human desire to want to settle the score, to want to get even. In fact, to give someone what they deserved. In fact, I remember when I was in high school, these kind of words were things that me and my friends said all the time. And so if someone, you know, punched you in the arm, you then had the right to punch them back in the arm. And we'd say, you know, you deserved it. And we'd say, you know, it's only fair. I get to get back at you for that. And we say these things all the time. It's a universal human desire to want to retaliate. Because we all have a very keen sense of justice when we are on the receiving end of a wrong. As soon as we've been wronged, we have a very keen sense of what's just and what's fair and what's right, and that is getting back at the other person for the way they wronged us. And Jesus here teaches a complete rejection of that attitude that comes so easily, a complete rejection of the attitude that seeks personal retaliation. What Jesus is saying here is that a Christian should never seek to even the score. A Christian should never give someone what they deserve. A Christian should never seek to get back at somebody for the way they've been wronged by someone. In fact, a Christian's attitude should be so far away from this attitude of retaliation that Jesus actually brings it all the way on the other side, not just that you shouldn't get back at somebody and repay evil for evil, but that you should seek to do good, seek out the good of other people, even if those other people would seek to wrong you. That Christians should go to the other end of the extreme and seek to do good to those who would want to do harm. Last week, I summed up the passage last week that that Jesus is teaching us to reject the notion of varying levels of truthfulness. Well, I think this week, Jesus' main point is this: reject the notion that you should never be wronged. So we're going to look at two main topics here. First, what Jesus' teaching means and doesn't mean. And second, where can you get the ability, the strength, the resources to live out what Jesus commands here? And so first, what Jesus' teaching means and it doesn't mean. Remember, Jesus just a few sentences ago, taught that he did not come to abolish the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them. And that what that does is set us up for what he's going to be saying. And it sets us up for it in this way. It sort of prepares us to not be misunderstood in this way, prepares us not to be misunderstood by thinking that Jesus is contradicting the Old Testament, but rather he's in perfect continuity with the Old Testament. He's even affirming the Old Testament in many ways here in this teaching. But what he is doing, what he is contradicting, is the distorted practice and the distorted teaching of the Pharisees that was so common in his day. So Jesus, when he says, you've heard that it was said this, but I say to you this, he's not saying, that's what it was said in the Old Testament, and that's what's wrong, and I'm going to give you what's right. He's saying, that might have been said in the Old Testament, but what I am criticizing is the wrong understanding of that, or the distorted teaching of that that's so common and so prevalent. And so we're going to look at three things on what Jesus' teaching means and doesn't mean. First, the original meaning in the Old Testament of this, what he quotes in verse 38, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. We're going to look at what that originally meant in the Old Testament. We're going to look at the distorted teaching and practice in Jesus' day. We're going to look at what Jesus is really trying to say in light of that distorted teaching and that context that Jesus is dealing with. So first, what was the original meaning of eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth in the Old Testament? Well, when we find that, I believe it's in three places in the Old Testament. And in those places, the clear context is that Jesus is laying out sort of a system for the civil authorities of that day. In other words, the context is in the law courts. And what it was meant to do was it was meant to ensure three things. First, it was meant to ensure fair and just penalties for crime. So what eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth meant was you can't overpunish or underpunish for a crime. So if somebody steals a loaf of bread, you can't execute them for that. That would be overpunishing a crime. If somebody murders someone else, you can't just slap them on the wrist for that. That would be underpunishing a crime. And so what eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth was meant to be was a principle of fairness and justice in society to keep order. And so you couldn't overpunish or underpunish. And even in that original context, I should probably say, and it was not always carried out exactly literally in that if someone gouged out someone's eye, they had to have their eye gouged out. They could pay restitution in a way that was sort of equivalent and fair. And so so it was meant to be, ensure fair and just penalties for crimes. Second, it was meant to ensure the same standard of justice without respect towards persons. What I mean by that is an eye for an eye meant that the same standard of punishment was used whether the person was rich or poor, whether a person was great or small, high or low on the social scale, that the same standard was used for everybody. So the same standard of justice without respect towards persons. And third, it was meant to discourage ongoing escalating feuds of retaliation, cycles of retaliation. In prescribing a fair and just, even response to a crime, what it prevented was ongoing escalating retaliation. And what I mean by that is this. So, you know, someone cuts off my brother's hand, so I go cut off their arm. So they go cut off my head, so I go, or someone else, I can't still be involved in this illustration. Someone else, my brother, goes and burns down their village. And where does it end? And so what this was meant to do was to have a crime be responded to in such a way that it would put the violence to an end, that it would put retaliation to an end, so that things would be squared away as much as possible. And so that's what it meant in the Old Testament context. But in Jesus' day, it had been distorted. And the original context was civil justice. But Jewish teaching and practice tended to put it back into the sphere of personal retaliation and personal vengeance. And so when Jesus says, don't resist evil, in verse 39, he's not saying that we should just let evil go unchecked in society and not have any laws against evildoers. But what he's saying is he's referring to private retaliation, not to public order. And so instead of an eye for an eye being a standard of fair penalties for the court promoting justice and peace, it became sort of justification for me to get back at somebody for any wrong they committed towards me. And even, practically speaking, it went even beyond that. it wasn't just a justification to get back at somebody, but it was sort of a justification to say, how far can I go without breaking the law and getting even? And so what it tended to promote was not only personal retaliation, but personal over-retaliation in a sense, such that someone would over-retaliate as far as they could without breaking the letter of the law in a sense. And so Jewish practice took this totally out of its context and flipped it on it, as we saw last week, it really flipped it upside down from what its original intention was meant to be. And so rather than promoting peace and fairness and justice, in practice it turned into an attitude that promoted vengeance and bitterness and revenge. And so what is Jesus dealing with? What is Jesus addressing in the midst of this? And he's not rejecting, as I mentioned, the Old Testament principle of justice, but he's rejecting personal retaliation when you've been wronged. What he's saying is, if you're my follower, you should reject the attitude that you should never be wronged. That you should reject the attitude that you should get back at people for every, that you have the right to get back at people for every slight, or for every offense, or for every harm they do to you. You should reject the attitude of always insisting upon and demanding upon your rights. You should reject the attitude that when your rights have been infringed, then you have the right to take matters into your own hands and right the wrong done to you. And in fact, you should so reject that attitude, no matter how prevalent it is with other people, you should so reject that attitude that you should take up the opposite attitude of sometimes, of not only allowing yourself to be wronged, but going the extra mile to do good to other people and to be self-sacrificing for other people and to seek out the good of other people. In other words, in Jesus' words, he that follows me must take up his cross. Someone's not happy back there. Charles Spurgeon put it this way: we are to be the anvil when bad men are the hammers. As Christians, we ought to expect to absorb undeserved wrong at times. And that's part of what it means to take up our cross to follow Jesus, because Jesus himself took up his cross to absorb undeserved wrongs. And so especially as Americans, this is challenging to us. We love our rights. We value highly our rights. Now, I should mention Jesus isn't throwing away the idea of rights completely out the window, but he is saying this, that if you want to be his follower, you have to die to your sense of entitlement. You have to be willing to lay down your rights. You can't think that you should never be wronged. Jesus says no, and you can't think that if you've been wronged, you then have the right to do wrong in return. The fact that you've been wronged doesn't give you the right to do wrong. That's almost assumed in our culture, I think, but it's not true. When someone has wronged you, you do not have to wrong them back. And to think otherwise really does make you a total victim of their wronging you. But to take ownership of that, to not be a complete victim, means you can take responsibility over your response to them and actually seek to do them good. And that's what Jesus commands here. And so before we go on, like I did last week, I want to mention a couple qualifications, clarifications, because Jesus, As I hope I've shown, Jesus is speaking into a particular context. And so often in the Sermon on the Mount, he's speaking into a particular context. And if you absolutize his words outside of those contexts, you can come to some dangerous, wrong-headed conclusions, I'm convinced. And so without removing the sting and the challenge of what Jesus is saying, I think we need to be careful about how we understand it. And so he's correcting the false teaching and the false practice of his day. He's not totally abolishing the idea of rights. And even the Apostle Paul, I think, is a great example in this. Because there are many, many times when, for the sake of the gospel, he laid aside his rights. But there are some other times when, for the sake of the gospel, he insisted upon his rights. And the difference there is this, that he wasn't insisting upon his rights for his own sake. He never retaliated against those who deprived him of his rights or wronged him. But he always did it, whether laying aside his rights or whether insisting upon them. He did it, what he did, when he knew that what he did would serve the advance of the gospel and his mission to reach people with it. And so Jesus isn't totally abolishing any sense of having rights here. And so let me mention a few clarifications. I mentioned the Charles Spurgeon sums up this passage this way: we are to be the anvil when bad men are the hammers. There's a difference, though, in being an anvil and being a doormat. And I think Jesus is not encouraging us to be doormats. He's not saying this, although to clarify my clarification, if you live this teaching out, you will at times feel like a doormat. But Jesus is not saying, what I think, when he says you should reject the attitude that you should never be wronged, he's not at the same time saying adopt the attitude that you should just always be wronged and never seek out any help or protection or recourse. Because Jesus is not saying you should be a weakling who simply allows himself to be trampled on. John Stott, in his commentary, put it this way: Jesus describes not weakness, but great strength, whose control of oneself and love for others are so powerful that he rejects absolutely every form of retaliation. You see, what he's saying there is, lashing out in response to being wronged is not a sign of strength, it's a sign of weakness. But resolute absorption of wrong can be a real sign of strength. And nevertheless, though, this passage can be a scary one to misinterpret. And let me just say this, that if you are a victim of abuse, of ongoing abuse especially, that what Jesus is saying to you is not that you should simply keep turning cheeks. And we'll get to the cheek, turning a cheek in a minute. But he's saying that you should not resort to personal retaliation and try to take matters into your own hand in order to get even and get back at someone who's harming you. But he's not saying that there's nowhere for you to turn. He's not saying that there's nowhere for you to find help. And in fact, especially as we remember the original meaning of this eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, we remember the whole context that there were civil authorities in place to protect people from evil. Jesus isn't saying we should just let evil overrun society. And the good news here is that you aren't alone if you're in a situation of abuse and you don't have to take things into your own hands. You are an innocent victim, and the law can help you and protect you and do what it can to right your wrong. And Jesus is not saying here you should not turn to the law. And the church can help you and protect you and do what you can to right the wrongs being done. And Jesus is not saying here that you should not turn to the church for help either. So he's not saying that you have to be a doormat and you have nowhere to turn for help if you're being mistreated or abused. Second, he's not saying you can't defend yourself or others. I think on face value, it appears that Jesus is saying that, and some have taken it in that way, that we have to respond with total pacifism, even if we're being physically attacked or assaulted. And people get that from when Jesus says, if someone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. But it's important to know that in the context, in Jesus' day, a slap on the cheek, he's not referring to a physical assault, where someone's, you know, seeking to harm you or take your life. He's referring to an insult, in fact, one of the highest insults. And so what Jesus is saying here is, if someone insults you, better to let them insult you again than to insult them back. What Jesus is not saying here is that if someone's physically assaulting you, that you should simply you know, keep allowing them to, or if someone's physically assaulting someone else, you should simply allow them to. The Old Testament allows for self-defense, and although it did regulate it, and I believe the way it regulated it was that it encouraged you to use the minimal amount of self-defense that was necessary to fix the situation. So if you could restrain the person and get help, you should do that rather than just kill them. And that's how I think the Old Testament deals with self-defense, but it never prohibits it. And so there are times when the civil authorities can't protect you. And Jesus is not saying that Christians can't protect themselves or especially others in those times. So third, Jesus, and related, I guess, Jesus is not advocating for total pacifism or for total anarchy in society. The New Testament does teach that the civil authorities are God's ordained instruments to carry out his will, not necessarily every aspect of his will, but specifically his will in that they're called to restrain and punish evil and reward and encourage good in society. And it even gives them the right to use the sword, which would be to punish evil. And so Jesus isn't contradicting those parts of the New Testament that teach that. He's simply reminding his hearers that the use of the sword and punishment and retaliation is left in the hands of the state and ultimately in the hands of God. It's not in your hands. Sometimes justice in our world will not be done. I hate that. That is incredibly saddening. That's incredibly frustrating. That's incredibly angering. But it's the truth, is that sometimes justice in this world will not be done. Sometimes you will be unjustly treated. And even sometimes the state, the civil authorities, will treat you unjustly or allow others to treat you unjustly. And that's probably what's happening in verse 40. It talks about if anyone would sue you and take your tunic, presumably undeservedly, then tough luck, I guess, right? And you can be mad about it and you can try to get them back, or you can respond to them with generosity and an open hand. Because a Christian is willing to part with things in this life, even valuable things, which the cloak would symbolize, is willing to part with even valuable things in this life because a Christian knows that he cannot lose the thing that matters most. No amount of injustice in this life can deprive you of anything that really counts for eternity. And so Christians can give their cloak, not just their tunic. Finally, Jesus is not teaching that you always need to give people everything and exactly what they ask of you. And I think in verse 41 and 42, he's given, as we've gone through this, we've seen four different examples that are meant to illustrate Jesus' point. And in 41 and 42, if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Probably what's happening there is it's a reference to the military, who had the right to force a civilian to carry their equipment or baggage, but only to carry for 1 mile. And so this is an example that even when you're imposed upon, instead of volunteering, to do it with a generous attitude, to give voluntarily and sacrificially. And then in verse 42, give to the one who begs from you and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you. The idea there, again, is to be generous, to be open-handed, to be self-sacrificing. Not just don't retaliate, but be self-sacrificing. But I think it's important to just mention that Jesus can't be telling you you always need to give people exactly and everything that they ask of you. First of all, that's not always possible. Second of all, that sometimes violates the very principle that Jesus is commending here, and that is love for others and seeking the good of others. So it's not always possible to do that, and it's not always loving to do it. In one book I was reading, the author describes a friend who committed himself to give money to every beggar that asked him. Unfortunately for them, they lived in a very impoverished city, And so the result of this commitment was that he impoverished himself so that he couldn't provide for himself or his family, and he got a lot of beggars drunk. And that helped neither him nor them. And so it would be wrong-headed to understand Jesus' command here to go the extra mile, to be loving in a way that enabled self-destructive behaviors. Sometimes giving people what they ask for only enables them to hurt themselves more. And the way to apply Jesus' command here is to be generous towards them, but maybe not give them what they ask for. And so one person put it this way: the only limit to the Christian's generosity will be a limit which love itself might impose. The limit which love itself imposes. So I think it's important to clarify those things, but I don't want to take away from the radical nature of what Jesus is saying here. Your boot-up mode in life should not be, what are my rights? But rather, your boot-up mode in life should be, how can I lay aside my rights in order to fulfill my duty to love others and seek their good with self-sacrifice and generosity? And so so that's our first point. What is Jesus teaching here? Second, how can Christians live like this? This is a very challenging way to live. Jesus' command here is extremely challenging. It's radical. How can we actually find the resources to actually do this? How can we have the inner strength to allow ourselves to be wronged and mistreated and our rights be infringed? Let me offer quickly three suggestions to how we can do that. Christians can do that because they worship a God who gives them more than they can get for themselves. Second, Christians can do that because Christians worship a God who makes everything right in the end. And third, Christians can do that because Christians worship a God who allowed himself to be wronged for our sakes. Let me just walk through these quickly. Because Christians can do this because they worship a God who gives them more than they could get for themselves. I was reading a book a while ago, and in this book, the author tells a story of a non-Christian who started reading the Bible and just one day decided, whatever I read today, I'm going to try to do. I'm going to try to put it into practice. And they read this verse, that if someone takes your tunic, give him your cloak as well. And so as this person went through their day, they sort of started forgetting about this, but then they went to the library. This was a college student. They went to the library. They went sat down at their assigned thesis desk, which I guess is a big deal. You get a thesis desk to do all your research. I don't know. But someone approached them and just started screaming at them and yelling at them and said, this is my desk. Get out of here. I'm taking this desk from you. Even though it was not his desk, it was her desk. And all of a sudden, she remembered what she had read that day and what she had committed herself to do, and she thought, oh, great, because she was mad. She wanted to just fight back. She wanted to insist on her rights. And you know what you know what she did? She said, okay, this isn't your desk, but I'm going to let you have it. And actually, the guy was reeling at this response. He expected a fight, and he's reeling at this. He's like, he's bewildered by this response, and he actually asks her, well, wait a second, why are you going to give this to me? And she said, because I've been reading the Bible, and she explained the verse that she read. And the guy said, why on earth would Jesus say such a stupid thing like that? And this, all of a sudden, the person who's telling the story says, it just clicked all of a sudden. It's like the lights turned on, and the non-Christian said, in response to that question, she said, I think it's because Jesus wants to give us more than we can get for ourselves if only we let him. And that is the truth and the promise of the whole New Testament, is that Jesus wants to give you immeasurably more than you could ever grasp for yourself if you'd only let him. There's another old story of a child begging for fruit at a fruit stand. And I don't know if this is a true story. It's just one of those stories that people tell, you know. But the child's every day begging for fruit. It's like, I don't know, figs. Begging for figs at the fig stand. And every day, the owner of the fig stand gets annoyed and shoos him off. Get out of here, kid, you know. You're getting in the way of paying customers. And but every day, the kid comes back and begs for figs. Finally, the owner of the fruit stand gets so fed up with this child coming up that he changes strategy and thinks, all right, I'll just appease him and give him some figs. And so he says, all right, take some. And the child just stands there and looks at him. He says, would you just take some and get out of here already? And the child continues to just stand there and stare at him. And so finally, in frustration and desperation, not knowing what to do, the owner of the fig stand just grabs two big handfuls of figs and plops them. It's so big that the child can't even get them. He has to, like, get his shirt and plops them in his shirt. And the child just gets a big smile on his face. And the owner of the fig stand says, well, why wouldn't you just take it? And the child says, because your hands are bigger than mine. Jesus' hands are bigger than yours. And you can grasp and grasp to insist on your rights and get what you deserve. But you won't get near what Jesus can give you if you'd only let him. So Christians worship a God who gives them more than they could get for themselves. Christians know that anything they could grab for in this world is easily lost. It's a guarantee you'll lose it. But what Jesus gives you can never be lost. Second, because Christians worship a God who makes everything right in the end. Tim Keller, in his book, The Reason for God, makes this argument that's sort of become very popular. He says, people often assume that if you believe in a God who punishes people, then you will be a vengeful, punishing person. And people often assume, on the other hand, that if you believe in a peaceful God who never would punish anybody, you'll be a peaceful person. The exact opposite is true. If you believe in a God who will never punish anybody, when you are really wronged in life, you will need to even the score, settle the score. But if you believe in a God who makes everything right in the end, then you don't have to take things into your own hands when you're really wronged in a way that really hurts. Because you can entrust that God, though his justice is delayed, it's never missed. It always comes. And you can trust yourself to him who judges justly. You can leave justice in the hands of God. You don't have to take it into your own hands. And in fact, knowing this makes you humble, because it reminds you that God rights all wrongs, even the ones you've committed. And if you really believe that God makes everything right in the end, it changes the way you view yourself, that the core of your identity is no longer someone who's primarily been wronged, but primarily someone who has done wrong, not only to other people, but to God himself. And if God isn't merciful, then we have no hope. So second, because Christians worship a God who makes everything right in the end, and finally, because Christians worship a God who allowed himself to be wronged for our sakes. Jesus is a perfect example of what he teaches here. In fact, 1 Peter, the Apostle Peter, describes Jesus in this way. Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. Isaiah 50 goes on and says this, I gave my back to those who strike and my cheeks to those who pull out the beard. I hid not my face from disgrace and spitting. There's no doubt in my mind that when C.S. Lewis wrote that passage about Aslan that we read earlier, he was thinking about Jesus at his trial, trial and mistreatment and eventually crucifixion. Jesus, who with one word could have stopped it all. Jesus, who he says, even with one word, could have called down legions of angels to defend him. instead voluntarily allowed himself to be mistreated by the very ones he came to save, by the very ones he created, by the very ones who owed him nothing but gratitude and respect and honor and praise and worship. He voluntarily allowed them to beat him and to mock him, to spit on him and to nail nails into his hands and feet. Instead of responding with retribution, he laid down his life. Jesus wasn't helpless, anything but that. But he had to have incredible, inconceivable inner strength to not do something, but to allow himself to be mistreated. Jesus didn't retaliate, but he allowed himself to be wronged by the very ones he came to save. He allowed himself to be wronged for us, to save us. And if he had given them what they deserved, if he had sought what he deserved, if he had given us what we deserved, we would have no hope. But Jesus didn't take what he deserved, said he could not give us what we deserved. So how can we be like Jesus? What can we do to put aside our rights and to consider the needs of others before our own? How can we endure mistreatment for the sake of Jesus and others? How can we lay down our life and take up our cross? Let's pray. Father, we thank you for Jesus, who, when being reviled, he did not revile. But Jesus, because of his great love for us, allowed himself to be mistreated and endured even death on a cross, that he laid aside his divine rights without ceasing to be divine, to die in our place. We thank you for Jesus. Please help us to take up our cross, to live in a way that reflects his example, and to give of ourselves sacrificially. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.